Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's disregard for the truth and whether he is delusional in his beliefs or simply a salesman who may or may not believe in his sales pitch. Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, Donald Trump's disregard for words and truth is finally catching up with him, and look into how much there are two separate universes at play in America, with liberals who watch MSNBC expecting Trump to be impeached at any moment, while conservatives inside the Fox News bubble see Trump as being wildly successful as his support amongst Republicans remains sky high. Then we will try to assess what is behind the Trump administration's apparent strategy to trash allies and undermine longstanding alliances while praising adversaries, in particular Vladimir Putin's Russia. Having insulted and hung up the phone on Australia's leader, Trump behaved boorishly and went out of his way to insult Germany's Angela Merkel, then blamed the UK for tapping his phone after the White House had promised the British PM that Trump would not repeat his ridiculous charges. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to examine whether Monday's testimony by FBI Director Comey will expose Trump as a liar who smeared his predecessor with reckless disregard, calling Obama a bad or sick guy. Then finally, we will speak with Ian Millhiser, the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. He joins us to discuss the upcoming confirmation hearings of Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Gorsuch, and whether grassroots pressure will force Democratic senators to play hardball like Mitch McConnell did with Obama's nominee, Judge Garland. And joining us now is Lawrence Douglas, professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Dukmanuk, and The Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, Donald Trump's disregard for words and truth is finally catching up with him. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Douglas.
Very glad to be here.
And Lawrence, do you think that, just in terms of my question in the opening, do you think Trump is, I mean, I think Trump is more delusional than a liar. I'm not sure what the distinctions are there, but is he a salesman who may or not believe in his sales pitch? Because obviously if you're a salesman, the more you believe in your pitch, the more convincing you are.
It's a very tricky thing. I mean, I think it's very, you know, I think we all have this great temptation to psychologize, to kind of try to step inside this guy's head and figure out exactly what he's doing. I, at least, would be loath to characterize him as delusional. In fact, one thing we could even ask ourselves is, does it really matter? Does it really matter our answer to the question as to whether he's delusional or whether he is kind of just exceptionally tactical or completely reckless with regard to his treatment of the truth? Maybe recklessness is a better characterization of his relationship to the truth. I guess if I were kind of going to play betting man, I would put the bet on that he's just reckless with regard to his use of truth. He's used to saying whatever seems advantageous to himself in the moment. And the reason he doesn't seem entirely delusional to me is that when it is no longer advantageous for him to continue to be saying A, he'll turn around on a dime and say not A. And he'll act as if there's no contradiction between those two statements at all, and that people who heard him first to be saying A never really understood, or he just doesn't even matter. He just kind of says, I said A, now I say not A. And it doesn't really kind of, no one really seems to be able to hold him account for it, except until, as I've said recently, when it seems that he might be starting to pay a political cost for his reckless disregard of the truth.
Well, Trump does believe, or at least he appears to believe, stuff that Alex Jones puts out. And Alex Jones is clearly delusional and I think believes his crazy conspiracy theories. Whereas Breitbart, Trump's other favorite source, they print lies, but they do so, I think, cynically and tactically. Whether or not they believe in this stuff or not seems to be beside the point. So can you be not be delusional and believe in delusional things?
The question is whether he believes the stuff.
I mean, it is
astonishing. I think we could all agree that it is astonishing that the President of the United States is receiving information, not just receiving information, but then touting the information that he receives from a source such as Alex Jones. That is astonishing. Whether he actually believes what he is receiving from Alex Jones, again, it's a little bit of a black box. It's hard to say. It seems like when he needs to find some type of support for the outlandish claims that he makes, he will then turn to whatever source will offer some support, however slender and ridiculous that support might be. Now, whether he actually is quoting those people because he believes them or because they are kind of serving the present moment, which is to create a kind of chaotic haze in which we're unable to agree on what's up or down or what's true and not true. Again, it's just very hard to say with this guy in the White House.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Dukmanik and the Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, Donald Trump's Disregard for Words and Truth is Finally Catching Up with Him. The thing that I find troubling, though, Lawrence, is that, for example, Trump trashed GCHQ, or at least his surrogates did, the British equivalent of the NSA. And what happens when there's a real crisis? And GCHQ, by the way, does provide a lot of frontline, very, very breaking kind of intelligence, early warning stuff. They were the first to provide information of Russia's involvement in hacking the DNC and John Podesta. But let's just, for the sake of an argument, say that the Russians were about to invade Estonia with the Green Men, you know, that kind of hybrid warfare type of invasion that they used on Crimea. And GCHQ were the first to pick up on it. And they sent a flash to General McMaster, the National Security Advisor. And, you know, McMaster can't even get into the Oval Office. He has to go through Stephen Bannon. And Stephen Bannon edits the daily intelligence brief that Trump gets. So, if assuming McMaster can actually get in with this warning from GCHQ and brief the president on it, would the president believe GCHQ or Alex Jones?
See, then now that's a terrific question because I mean I think one of the things that we've spent so much time focusing on is the ludicrous things that Trump appears to believe. And as you rightly ask, perhaps the more important question to ask is what about the truthful things that he doesn't believe or that he won't pay attention to? And one hopes that, I'm not sure if I would describe it entirely as a bright light of the administration, but it does seem to be the case that he has a relatively experienced national security staff in place. I mean, you do have people. I mean, you talked about McMaster as the national security advisor. You know, you have Mattis, Secretary of Defense, Tillerson, Secretary of State. And these people seem to have a somewhat more hard-boiled and realistic and sophisticated understanding of the workings of the world. And one can only hope that in light of very credible information coming from intelligence sources, that these persons would be able to prevail upon the president to make rational and reasoned decisions. You know, I guess up until the time that we really have the president having to respond to a genuine crisis instead of creating crises of his own with our closest allies, with Australia, Britain, and Germany, we won't really have a clear answer to that question. But the question really is, it's the terrific one, and in a certain one, it's the one that we really should be focusing on, perhaps, instead of, again, all this tension being rightfully, on some level, paid to the bizarre things that Trump appears to believe in, again, whether he does so or not.
Well, but then if you broaden this out to the country at large, as I mentioned in the opening, there are two separate universes at play in America, with liberals who watch MSNBC expecting Trump to be impeached at any moment, while conservatives inside the Fox News bubble see Trump as being wildly successful as his support amongst Republicans remains sky high. Now, it does seem that a lot of what the Democrats believe and MSNBC believe is, I think you could even say, delusional. I mean, Trump is, as far as his supporters are concerned, he's doing incredibly well. And if you live inside the Fox bubble, of course, you get their news and Rush Limbaugh, et cetera, and you would think that he's just walking on air and things are really hunky-dory. And frankly, I think he will get his... It's not like they have a new health care plan. They just want to wreck Obamacare, and they will wreck Obamacare. They'll get something passed. They will get most of their budget through. They probably will get Gorsuch through as well, and then be able to stack the court to the right for decades to come. So in the eyes of Trump supporters, he's doing incredibly well.
Which is, again, one of the reasons why I suppose, again, when I said, about this question about is he delusional or is he somewhat more just a kind of reckless and tactical in his distortions of the truth, I kind of favor the latter because, again, I suppose that if it were the case that Trump was experiencing reversal after reversal, even with his own core group, and still sticking to his outlandish claims, then I think we might want to conclude that he is delusional. But the fact of the matter is, to the extent that he continues to reap political benefits from these distortions of the truth, and he continues to enjoy widespread support among his base, and to the extent that he has a pretty far-flung media apparatus in place, which is not going to call him to account for these distortions of the truth, why wouldn't he continue doing them? I mean, it has gotten him to the place that he is today. I mean, his political rise is the result not, again, of having done anything kind of spectacular, coming up with great ideas. It's for lying and making people accept those lies. So I don't see why he would really have incentive to back off a strategy, which up until now, at least, has rewarded him not just handsomely, but kind of spectacularly.
So what do you think it will take to prick the Fox News bubble and to educate Trump supporters about how he's basically shafting them? But my sense is that there's two Achilles heels that Trump has. One, he craves the approval of the celebrity culture that he worships, and he's obviously on the tawdry side of celebrity culture, like the Kardashians, but he still nevertheless wants the approval of celebrities, and he's not getting that, and apparently that drives him crazy. He hates Hollywood, but he'd love to be accepted by Hollywood. And then the other one is that I think he's really undignified in every sense. You know, we have a political head of state, not a queen or a royal family like they do in the UK and other countries. But nevertheless, even during Bill Clinton's impeachment, he still behaved presidentially, and so did Obama. He was always very reserved and cautious about what he said. Trump is a catastrophe. He's a dog's breakfast. He's just all over the place, and it's embarrassing. But nevertheless, his own children, Ivanka, apparently believes that they are the new royal family, that America wants nobility, and that the Trump family will provide it. But again, I think she's delusional. I think that is his Achilles heel, that he is so unpresidential and so undignified that eventually that's probably going to start to bother people.
Yes, and I guess the question is, what people is it going to bother? And I think there are a lot of different audiences out there. And so obviously we have already tens of millions of Americans who are absolutely appalled by him. Obviously we have hundreds of millions of people around the world who are appalled by him. But I guess the other thing is that I think we can probably say that the federal judiciary is appalled by him. We can probably say with some degree of confidence that there are thousands, tens of thousands of people within the federal bureaucracy who are appalled with him. And then, of course, you have the people within the Republican Party itself and the Republican within the Republican Congress. And you can see their profound ambivalence with this guy. On one level, they see him as the vehicle with which they can ride to legislative victories. You can see on another level that they're quite terrified of crossing him in terms of what that would mean to their own political viability. At the same time, you can see that they're also appalled by him as well. And you see that they're now increasingly starting to hedge their bets. So you have people, you know, like Richard Byrd, the head of the Senate, the senator who's the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, coming out and saying, look, there's no evidence whatsoever of these outlandish claims that Obama tapped his phone. You have Devin Nunes, head of the House Intelligence Committee, coming out making a similar claim. And you can see they're hedging their bets. And I think to the extent that, as you point out, that, you know, to the extent that he continues to behave not just in this kind of undignified fashion, but in a really reckless fashion, I think you'll find the Republican leadership and the rank and file of the Republicans in Congress become increasingly impatient with him. And if he's not helping them deliver their legislative agenda, then they'll just turn against him. And so I do think that that is a serious Achilles heel, as you point out.
Well, Lawrence Douglas, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Ian. Great talking with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Dukmanik, and The Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, Donald Trump's Disregard for Words and Truth is Finally Catching Up with Him. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back trying to assess what is behind the Trump administration's apparent strategy to trash allies and undermine longstanding alliances while praising adversaries. Tell me. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Ian, great to be with you.
Well, thanks, Scott. And what can we make of this apparent strategy of the Trump administration to trash allies and undermine longstanding alliances while praising adversaries, in particular Vladimir Putin's Russia? As I mentioned in the opening, which you didn't hear, he hung up the phone on the Australian leader. He behaved boorishly and went out of his way to insult Germany's Angela Merkel, then blamed the UK for tapping his phone after the White House had promised the British PM that Trump would not repeat his ridiculous charges. And I have to add to that that his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, insulted the South Koreans who'd prepared a state banquet for him. And Tillerson said he was sorry he couldn't attend because he was fatigued. So it's across the board. It seems like a policy. How does it strike you?
Exactly that way. I think it's mystifying. If you try to approach it from the perspective of some shift of policy of some sort. There's no policy that says we should go out and systematically insult and damage relations with every major alliance we have. That makes no sense whatsoever. But I think the only thing that serves to make sense of everything is if you assume that he is bought into and is trying to support the foreign policy initiatives of a foreign power, namely Russia, because, of course, Russia is seeking to divide NATO and to damage relations between the major NATO powers, U.S., U.K., and Germany would certainly be the three most important. And Trump seems to be setting out systematically to do all of that. So if we're looking, we're hearing all these claims now about Russian manipulation and hacking as a favor that Russia did for Trump. And the question is, but what is Trump doing for Russia? The answer is we're seeing it right now.
Well, you know, one of the things that's hard to understand is the extent to which American and European leftists, to some degree, still make excuses for Trump, for Putin, and think that critics of Putin's meddling in the elections are a new kind of McCarthyism and Cold War rhetoric. I mean, the bottom line is that this is not a struggle between capitalism and communism. I mean, I guess, you know, they think we're still back in the Cold War. This is a struggle between democracy and autocracy. So how much do you think Trump, Bannon, and all these people really want to have a global rule of autocrats?
Well, I would say that the ideological element that you hear suggested by people like Glenn Greenwald, that simply makes no sense. We aren't dealing with a struggle between Marxist and the Western powers. It's more a question of national alignments. And I think in the case of Trump, the only way to make sense of things here is not to look for evidence of strategies that advance the national interests of the United States. I don't think there are any, but look for strategies that advance the personal interests of Donald Trump, and there I think we see it. And in fact, you know, we've seen a couple of very significant stories published in the course of this last week, one by Bloomberg, one by Reuters, looking at how the Trump Organization itself benefited from relations with Russian investors who seem to be principally Russian oligarchs, very close to the Kremlin. We have a Reuters piece just tallying up investments in a couple of projects in South Florida, coming up with $100 million. But in fact, you know, it's quite clear that we're looking at many hundreds of millions of dollars, certainly $500 million, probably closer to $1 billion. Flowing into the Trump Organization in the period after his last wave of bankruptcies, which is 2004, 2005, 2006. So clearly this strategy is personally profitable to him. And I think he also, you know, wants a world in which his advantages, in which his position as president of the United States will advantage him and his businesses. I think we've seen that also in China recently, where there was a manufactured confrontation with China, and then this seems to be smoothed over and resolved after the Chinese grant him trademark concessions. Pretty spectacular series of events, and I think they point to the wisdom of the U.S. Constitution and the Emoluments Clause, which prevent a president or senior officer of the government receiving payments from a foreign power, a clause which is being violated on a constant, almost daily basis by this government.
So the kind of world that Trump and Putin want is pretty much the kind of world that you already have in Russia, right? You've got a bunch of oligarchs being regulated by Putin, who gets a cut of everything, from what I understand.
And I think, yes.
And then...
It's a capitalist system.
Yeah, it is. It's
a kleptocratic capitalist
right.
system.
Right. Well, but that isn't that what our oligarchs would love? They don't like the government. The Koch brothers hate the government. This uber libertarian Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca, who are the biggest supporters, financial supporters of Trump, and in many ways helped elect him more than anybody probably. I mean, these all the privately held companies that Trump has, et cetera, the American oligarchs, how would you compare them to Russian oligarchs?
Well, they're different to some extent in how they acquired their wealth and how they manage it, because I think the American oligarchs are absolutely and totally independent of the state. The Russian oligarchs acted independently and dominated the state during the Yeltsin years, and after Putin came to power, we're talking about beginning about 1999, and this has been documented very effectively by people like Masha Gessen. After 1999, Putin began a gradual process of reining in and controlling the oligarchs, and those who would not kowtow to him and accept his ultimate mastery were largely forced out of the country, and quite a number of them died under mysterious circumstances, too. So that dynamic is really quite different. But in terms, let's look at in terms of the international order and what kind of world do they want. And I think there is some agreement that is they don't like the constraints that are imposed by the liberal world order that was created in the ashes of World War II. Things like the United Nations, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the IMF, the EU, and so forth. All of these institutions put a tight framework on how the world as a whole operates and limit their ability to act and also to steal, because there are all sorts of limitations on kleptocracy that are imposed through this system. So I think there is a shared interest in eroding or peeling back much of this system. And that takes you back to a global system that's like the one we had in the 1930s.
So, again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So if in this world that could come to pass, if you know, when you look at the emerging country, I mean, China has managed to maintain an authoritarian government in totally compatible with capitalism, and that's what you have in Russia, and that appears to be what Trump would like to institute here. So that's the sort of dystopian possibility, and it does seem that liberal democracies are on their back foot, and liberalism in general is defensive. I mean, I don't know what happened to the liberals, particularly in this country. You know, they dominated the government and the Supreme Court up through the 70s, and then suddenly they seem to have lost heart. I mean, every important victory in terms of human progress, whether it was ending slavery, women's rights, women's votes, children's rights, human's rights, stopping the fascists in World War II, rescuing capitalism from the Depression in the 1930s. All of the heavy lifting was done by liberals, and all the conservatives ever said was no, 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 no. So we live in a political environment where the conservatives have taken over. And they're about to, I think, have a lot of electoral victories. They'll destroy Obamacare. They'll get their budget through. They'll probably get Gorsuch on the court and turn it to the right forever. So, what explains the traditional Republicans' craven behavior in tolerating, if not making, a kind of tacit alliance with the wrecking crew in the White House? What explains their shameless fealty, or you know, alliance with Trump?
Well, I think, you know, we have seen a conversion. I mean, you talk about this as the fading away of liberalism. But in fact, if we look at this label liberalism, it's meant historically different things in different countries at different times. And the liberal brand, well, we can probably say that there are sort of a core set of principles that go with liberalism everywhere. I mean, starting with the embrace of Adam Smith and this notion of market capitalism is sort of a core value of liberalism. Liberal, if we say the word liberal in Central and Northern Europe, everyone would instantly understand, well, that means conservative. That's the right wing, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, if we say it in the United States or Canada, liberal means left of center. Or in U.S. dialogue these days, it even means socialism, which, of course, is historically the opposite of what liberalism means. So we have a sort of corrupted a label for it. But then with the Republicans and what's happened with the Republicans, one of the core problems is, what does the Republican Party stand for? And it is migrated. I mean, there we've seen, you know, more dramatic change over time than with any other political party. And that's continued under Trump. So, you know, the Republican Party historically has been the party of the upper middle class. It's been sort of a solid, a sort of dowdy conservatism in the United States. But Trump has infused this with a sort of nationalistic, ethnically based, even white supremacist populism. And that's something that the Republican Party historically had stood against. So it's really turned somewhat on its head. And at the same time, the Democrats have have succeeded in capturing the upper middle class, well-educated white elites, which historically have been Republicans. So things have all turned somewhat topsy-turvy. I'm not so sure that for the long run things look good for the Republicans. I think rather they don't. But for the short run, I think you're right. For the next year and a half, 2 years, we're probably going to see more radical Republican legislation than we've seen in a very, very long time. And that includes, you know, a transformation of the healthcare environment. With the striking down of Obamacare, perhaps some new legislation in its place, perhaps not. That standing on its own, that affects a very large part of the total economy of the United States and virtually every citizen. So that's quite striking. Probably also going to see rolling back of voting rights. And in the foreign arena, a really radical transformation, you know, perhaps moving to, stepping away from the historical embrace of free trade, which has been centerpiece of American foreign policy since the days of Cordell Hull and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and potentially a lot of damage done to organizations like NAFTA, like the EU, like the World Trade Organization. That's all very radical.
Well, Let's turn then to what's happening Monday with the hearing before the House Intelligence Committee, chaired by Devin Nunes, who was part of the Trump campaign and has done absolutely every mental gymnastic possible to defend Trump, but finally had to admit that Trump's remarks trashing Obama and claiming he was being wiretapped by Obama were beyond the pale and were unsupported. He's saying that there's no collusion or any evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, which is what Clapper had said, the director of national intelligence, earlier. Adam Schiff, the Democratic minority head of the House Intelligence Committee, says that that's not true. There is circumstantial evidence of collusion. There is direct evidence, I think, of deception, and that's where we begin the investigation. So the broad question I would have is the original statement from all 17 intelligence community agencies that came out before the elections saying that Russia had interfered in the elections at the direction of Putin and did so to help Trump. That was an amazing bombshell. That was an equivalent of a kind of Pearl Harbor, yet it landed like a dud. Obama never picked it up, never did anything about it. And you would have thought, with such an extraordinary charge, that Donald Trump himself would want to clear his name, but he never did. And this is, I think, one of the most amazing moments in American history, that this outrageous charge by the intelligence community has somehow fizzled. So where are we between that charge that was never acted upon and this latest these latest charges, which are going to be aired tomorrow, in particularly with Comey, the FBI director's testimony?
I think we're going to see some remarkable and important disclosures tomorrow in this hearing. I think, you know, we've James Comey has been to Capitol Hill several times before. He's really declined to give much information at all. I think that position's not tenable anymore. I think he's now got to come forward and has to put, even on the public record, not in a closed session, some pretty significant information about what's going on. So I predict that tomorrow he will disclose publicly for the first time the existence of a counterintelligence investigation that's been going on since last summer. I think he's going to note that it involves a number of members of the Trump campaign team and staff, some of whom have continued to work with Trump today. I don't think he's going to identify them by name. But he's also going to say that this focuses on their communications and dealings with Russian agents. The whole FISA Act, which is what's authorized this, and there is a FISA court order under it, this is all about dealing with foreign agents. I mean, in the absence of that, there's no investigation. So the fact that the investigation has been going on for so long and is continuing now, and I think he's going to say that too, that would not be possible without evidence having been upturned of a significant number of contacts with foreign agents. Now, some of that's come out in the public already with Michael Flynn, but quite a bit of it hasn't. And it's going to come to a couple of major focus points. So one of those focus points is collusion in connection with the hacking. And on this score, as you said, Nunez says that that he's seen no information. That's basically because he hasn't opened his eyes and has closed his ears, because the information is there and he's been briefed about it. I've been told that. And specifically, there are 16 incidents of communication which have been documented between Roger Stone, who is one of the most senior Trump advisors, and a Russian hacker who was being instructed and directed by the GRU, and who certainly played a role. That's 16 separate meetings between them. That's one case. Second, Nigel Farage, the UKIP leader in the UK, has also been detected and has figured in this investigation, and has been detected repeatedly having meetings both with individuals involved in the hacking, Russian agents, and Julian Assange, so that he appears as one of the plausible counterparts. And he, of course, worked as an advisor for Trump during the campaign and appeared and spoke at a number of Trump campaign functions. So that's just two, and that's not the whole end of the story, because I understand that there are at least four other individuals from the campaign who figure in this. So that's on the question of hacking and manipulation or collusion with the Russians in hacking. And there's definitely good evidence of that. But the second question, and I think Comey will talk about this too, has to do with the flow of money. What they've picked up is that there is very, very substantial flow of money going on between the Russians and the Trump Organization in the background. And some of that was reported in Chris Steele's briefings. A fellow named Mikhail Kalugin, who was at the embassy, and that's something I understand that U.S. intelligence has now confirmed, that his reporting on all of that was accurate, and that Mr. Kalugin was a sort of an accounts manager for this whole system. So I doubt we're going to get much detail from Comey about this, but I think he at least is going to give some sense of the generic, what the areas are that are being examined.
So, Scott Horton, what did you make of Louise Mensch's op-ed in Saturday's New York Times, where she was basically advising, she said that Nunez is basically he's going to not have any worthwhile witnesses because of his bias, but she's like everybody on the Democratic side, they're counting on Adam Schiff, but she lists the people that she would hope he does they do subpoena, and one of whom is Eric Prince, the brother of Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, and she's suggesting that he this is the question that she would want them to ask. Did you have any knowledge during the campaign of serving FBI agents and police officers whom Rudy Giuliani, Eric Prince, and Mr. Flynn claimed were leaking information to them? Did you advise anybody involved that this was against the law? If not, why not? Now, what is going on there, do you think? That's an interesting little piece of sort of sidebar, but still interesting.
Her op-ed piece in the Times is very, very good. And I think, I think people have different opinions about Louise Minch. And, she's frequently accused of being a conspiracy theorist. Well, she is a conspiracy theorist. She's also been right about a number of very important points here where people had dismissed or overlooked good points. And this op-ed piece, I think, is really extremely good. I think it's something like a map of essential questions that need to be asked. And what she's picking up here, and it's a very, very sound point she's picked up, is that there was a sort of cabal involving people in the FBI in New York. And if you check media reports just before the James Comey letter, and about the week before that letter, and the week after the letter, so we're talking about the tail end of the campaign, the wires were live in New York City with reports and discussions about what James Comey was going to do and the bomb he was going to, or the stick he was going to put in the spokes of the Clinton campaign. Eric Prince was one of the people who was found talking about this. Rudy Giuliani was. There are about a half dozen people who were picked up, mostly in local media in New York City, some in national media. And, of course, what they said and what they knew all turned out to be correct, suggesting that there was something there. There was a sort of cabal. Eric Prince is also, of course, he's also the brother of Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, who got a big payoff for her support. And he has been working as a security consultant for the United Arab Emirates and has been heavily involved in a number of very odd projects in the Middle East, including most recently in Libya, supporting General Haftar, the renegade general who's being supported by the Russians. And Libya, so we see indirect and actually direct connections with the Russians involving Eric Prince. All not definitive in any way, but providing more than an adequate basis to put some pointed questions to him. So I think she's right. He is one of the people who should be picked up, brought in, and questioned, as is Rudy Giuliani.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Scott Horton, of course, Eric Prince, by the way, has a mercenary army there in the UAE, and some reports I've heard from JSOC indicate that he may be the means by which the Trump administration could provoke a little war with the Iranians, which is a whole other subject matter. But just back to tomorrow's important hearings before the House Intelligence Committee. The Trump people now look like they're trying to cover their tracks to cover up this insult to Obama, which Trump clearly it doesn't want to apologize, but should. And now they're going to sort of say, well, it was a part of what the NSA calls incidental collection, you know, which is what happened with Flynn. You know, Flynn got picked up because they were monitoring the Russian ambassador. Any other shoes to drop there? Because I heard a report that Flynn himself, first of all, he's been taking an awful lot of money from Russians, and he may well have been involved with a female Russian FSB agent.
I keep looking in The Guardian every morning expecting to see a story show up, but I haven't seen it yet. No, I think there are quite a few more shoes to drop on the Michael Flynn story. And, you know, he may be the victim of incidental collection, but that incidental collection is supposed to be minimized, of course. That is, they're supposed to remove from it the American. They didn't do that in this case. And I think there's only one plausible explanation for why they didn't do so, and that is this FISA court order that was issued on October 15, 2016. So I think it's a safe inference from all of this that the scope of that order included Michael Flynn. I think probably also Paul Manafort, probably also three or four other people close to Trump were covered by it. But it's not all of their dealings are covered by it. It's only their dealings with Russian agents, and particularly Russian intelligence agents. So dealing with the Russian ambassador Kisiak, of course that would have been covered. I think we're likely over the next few weeks to see gradually more and more of that. And, you know, from what I'm hearing, there are a very, very large number of contacts that were recorded and were captured pursuant to this subpoena. So, you know, I think a part of the problem we've got when you hear people like General Clapper say, you know, we can't, we see no evidence of collusion, that's because a lot of the information they have is, it documents that the contact occurred at a certain date in a certain way, but they don't have the contents of the contact, so they can't say it's collusion.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My great pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served serves on the American branch of the International Lawyers Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the upcoming confirmation hearings of Trump Supreme Court nominee Judge Gorsuch. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Millhiser.
It's good to be back. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Ian. And what's your sense then of whether or not the Democratic senators will be, you know, I believe they are under grassroots pressure and
right.
to play hardball, just like Mitch McConnell did with Obama's nominee, Judge Garland. So will this be a political event as opposed to a sort of judicial event?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that there are plenty of Democrats. I mean, right out the gate, you had several come out against Judge Gorsuch. You know, Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, Elizabeth Warren. You know, basically all the people who may be potentially be presidential candidates, plus a few others. And that I think is good news. You also have a lot of Democrats that I think, frankly, just want this thing to go away. I think that part of the problem, and this is a problem that, you know, the left of center coalition in the United States needs to fix, is that they have been out hustled on the judiciary. There's so much money on the right on this. There's a great deal of enthusiasm amongst the conservative groups. And I think that what there's some Democrats are thinking is, well, you know, I don't really like this guy, but if I vote yes on him, then I don't have to deal with the NRA coming after me on him. I don't have to deal with all the other big money groups coming after me. If I vote no on him, or if I vote no on him, like the people that I'm going to make happy just aren't as likely to give me as much trouble. And, you know, and that's a problem. Like, I think that most Democratic senators are going to do the right thing here, but I don't think they're feeling the amount of pressure that they need to feel.
And, of course, the Republicans are already already blanketing the airwaves in areas, in states, for example, like Heidkamp is being up for a re-election. They're blitzing the airwaves with accusing her of being against Gorsuch and being in favor of abortion and every other thing. So they're obviously, and I've seen ads, by the way, of a woman who said she used to clerk for Gorsuch, and they've been playing here in Los Angeles. So there's some serious money out there lobbying. I've never seen pro Supreme Court nominee ads before on blanketing the airwaves. So it looks like the conservatives are really serious about it. But Chuck Schumer, for example, made the point that, you know, John Roberts was a very handsome, genial guy, just like this guy,
right.
Gorsuch is. And he said he would just be the umpire and call balls and strikes. And what did he do? He turns out to be the probably number one Republican strategist in the land. He's the guy that got them unlimited money via Citizens United and struck down the important part of the Voting Rights Act, which meant they could suppress the vote of the Democrats. So, and that's helped them maintain a majority position. So do you think that that's a valid warning that this guy could be a wolf in sheep's clothing?
Well, I think this wolf comes as a wolf. I don't think that there's any sheep about it. You know, when you look at his record suggests that he's going to be to the right of Justice Scalia, who's the very conservative justice that he's been nominated to replace, that he could be as far to the right as the most conservative member of the court, Justice Thomas. And that means a lot of bad substantive outcomes. It also means, the vote that sticks out in my mind, the scariest thing that the Supreme Court did last year, is a lower court struck down North Carolina's big voter suppression law. And this is an outrageous law. What the lower court said is that state legislatures basically gathered data on racial voting patterns, so how black people vote, how white people like to vote, and then they designed the law using this data in order to exclude as many black people as possible and minimize the impact on white people. It's something out of Jim Crow. Four justices, all four of the Republican appointees, voted to reinstate this voter suppression law. And when Gorsuch gets there, he's probably going to be the fifth vote saying that these kinds of voter suppression laws are okay. That's terrifying, that should be terrifying for everyone. But the people who should be especially terrified of that are Democratic senators. Because how do they think that, if they're worried about their reelect, how much fun do they think their reelect is going to be if every state that has conservative governance is able to pass voter suppression laws that make it so that people who normally turn out to vote for Democrats can't vote?
Well, it's pretty obvious that we know that he clerked for Justice Kennedy, but apparently when he was at the Supreme Court as a clerk, Neil Gorsuch, he came to become a huge admirer of Clarence Thomas. As you just pointed out, he'll be, if not to the right of Thomas, at least he'll be, there in the same... on the same poll as Thomas and clearly changed the entire court. And then the assumption is that it would allow Kennedy to retire. And Kennedy's 80 years old. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's 84. I think one of the other justices is also in his late 70s, Breyer. So they could really get another bite at the apple. So what can the Democrats do? I mean, just short of just, absolute relentless trench warfare.
Well, absolute relentless trench warfare is what they need to be doing. I mean, the reason we're in this position now is because Senate Republicans stole the seat. You know, the reason we're in this position now is because a vacancy opened when Barack Obama was president. Republicans decided they weren't going to let Barack Obama fill the seat. They held it open in the hopes that Donald Trump would win, and through the magic of FBI Director James Comey, Donald Trump managed to win despite the fact that he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes, and now here we are. And, you know, if the Democratic Party's response to that is to say, oh, we better play nice, then the message that sends to the GOP is that their tactics work, that they can push like that, they can play games like they played with Obama, and there's no penalty for it. In fact, there's a big reward because they get control of the Supreme Court.
And how is that going to play in the court of public opinion? In other words, the Republicans are going to just go after them as being obstructionists. I mean, it's so hilarious when you think of what incredible obstructionists Mitch McConnell and company have become. But if Donald Trump can get away with lying, every other word that comes out of his mouth is a lie, right, and somehow that doesn't bother too many Americans, at least it certainly doesn't bother Trump supporters, Where is this going to come out in terms of, are the Democrats going to look like they're taking a principled stand, or are they going to look like petulant, spoiled kids?
Well, I don't think that Donald Trump is getting away with anything. I mean, Gallup just came out with a poll today showing him with an approval rating of 37%, which is lower than Obama's approval rating ever dropped. Like, you know, Donald Trump is more unpopular now than Obama was at his most unpopular moment. You know, 37% is a disastrous approval rating. And so, you know, I don't think that Democrats need to fear Donald Trump. I think that Donald Trump is doing a fine job of imploding on his own. What they do need is they do need to be able to challenge him in a free and fair election in 2020. And, you know, Trump's best shot at getting reelected is to have someone like Neil Gorsuch on the court to make sure that, that a voting rights regime is not friendly to people who actually want to vote.
So how would you frame that, the argument that the Democrats should have in a succinct manner?
Well, I mean, all you got to know to vote no on this guy is to look at his record. I mean, mm-hmm. he voted against birth control in the Hobby Lobby case. He tried to defund Planned Parenthood. He wants to, you know, there's a lot of indications that he wants to dismantle much of the federal regulatory state, so we can't have things like the Clean Air Act function in the way it's supposed to function. So we can't have things like, you know, the Department of Labor protecting workers. And all of that should be really frightening. I mean, the fact that the conservatives on the Supreme Court are one vote away from giving a green light to any state that wants to pass comprehensive voter suppression laws, that should scare people. You know, I don't think that this is – you need a message poll. You need a messaging poll for this. I don't think you need to think that hard about you know, how you frame this one. You just tell people what this man stands for, and I think it speaks for itself.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Ian Millhiser.
All right, thank you.
And again, I mean, speaking with Ian Millhiser, he's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.